dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week we'll continue with a look at the global economic situation from an anti-capitalist perspective. I'm going to continue with more selections from the five-part series Capitalism and Its Discontents, produced for Pacifica Radio by Eric Klein, Eddie Yuan, Ramsey Kanan, and Sasha Lilly. It was originally aired in the second week of February. Before we begin, I'd like to give you a definition of a term you're going to hear used often in the program, neoliberalism. This term is used in most of the world to describe the economic ideology, which in the U.S. is often called free markets, globalization, free trade, laissez-faire capitalism, the Washington Consensus, or the Chicago School. These terms all refer to a type of capitalism in which government services are increasingly privatized and corporate activity and markets are subjected to less or no regulation of their activities. This economic ideology of the supremacy of markets has dominated the United States for more than two decades, and its results may be presently viewed. From the standpoint of those who reject capitalism as fundamentally immoral, neoliberalism represents the pinnacle of everything that is wrong with it. It is a system that strives to create global corporate rule. The term liberalism, when used in the economic sense, refers to markets with little to no state intervention in prices, capital flows, or preferential treatment for national over transnational capital. In other words, restrictions over market activity are liberalized. The freedom goes to the capital, not to the people.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism and Its Discontents.
Now, the other thing, of course, capitalists can't control is popular revolt and popular resentment.
Welcome to Capitalism and Its Discontents, a special five-part series on the economic crisis gripping the globe. I'm Sasha Lilly.
Today, Portugal nationalizes banks, Spain does too, so does England, the United States has nationalized banks. This is the socialism of the rich that we are experiencing.
The government has been extraordinarily arrogant. Sometimes power can produce passive citizenry who accept whatever power does, but in this particular case, it's producing rebellion.
We need to be angry, we need to see a popular movement that says, no, wait, this kind of money that's just been wasted has got to go to us. We get a bigger cut of the pie. We get health care. We get higher wages. We restore union rights.
Today on Capitalism and Its Discontents, we'll take a look at the ferment in France in the wake of a general strike. We'll hear from global justice activist Andrei Gribacek about what debates within and directions for the left have come out of the World Social Forum in Belém, Brazil. And we'll speak with radical geographer Richard Walker about getting a handle on finance capital in the midst of the crisis.
Few years ago, you couldn't really talk about capitalism. Now, if you talk to people in the streets, everybody is talking about capitalism. And I think this opens a huge possibility for the left. But left needs to get very serious, needs to get organized, needs to start talking about vision, about alternatives, and about different strategies.
France was recently paralyzed by a general strike in which 2.5 million people took to the streets. The country has been hit with mass layoffs and cuts in working hours, and popular discontent is mounting. Students and faculty in the French university system are now gearing up for a nationwide strike. Eric Klein reports.
One step forward, three steps back. That's government politics. That's one of the chants from the massive street demonstrations that took place 2 weeks ago in France. Between 1 and 2 million people took part. I spoke with Philip Golub, professor of international relations and international political economy at the University of Paris and the American University of Paris, about the situation there.
Arrogance is producing rebellion because these very arrogant people in power who made the claim that they knew exactly what they were doing are now proving themselves to be incapable in periods of crisis of actually solving the crisis.
Golub says that a sharp downturn in industrial activity throughout Europe is leading to large job losses in the interrelated economies of the Union. Golub predicts that French unemployment will reach 11% soon. In response to the strong recession, French President Nicolas Sarkozy has proposed a 26 billion euro stimulus plan.
It's much too small. You know when the Chernobyl reactor blew up in Ukraine? Many years ago, the French government at the time made the totally insane and nonsensical claim that the radioactive cloud stopped at the French border. Now, they're basically doing the same thing now as far as the social crisis is concerned. They're saying everybody else, but not us. They're saying Gordon Brown, but not us. Germany, but not us. And people in the streets understand that that's not true.
This comes within the context of Sarkozy's ongoing plans to reform much of the French social system, which Golub calls a pale variant of what Margaret Thatcher did to England in the 1980s, cutting down the public sector. At the top of Golub's list of concerns for what Sarkozy is doing is the university system of France. Public higher education in France is basically free, but Golub says that Sarkozy's proposed reforms could put an end to that.
What Sarkozy is trying to progressively transform that educational system into a more competitive system in the sense of economic competition, to make it more acceptable to industry and the private sector, and to create a competition between various universities, which would ultimately lead the French university system to follow an American or a British kind of model in which fees would rise. There would be a process of selection of the better universities rather than the less good universities. In other words, it would change the nature of the French university system from being an egalitarian or at least a fair system towards being a competitive system.
Golub says that Sarkozy has angered everyone in the French university system, students, professors, researchers, even the conservative trade unions, and that a general strike throughout the French university system is likely in the next 2 weeks. This in addition to France's labor unrest.
The crisis is unquestionably the worst since the 1930s. Now, this means rapidly rising unemployment. It means a certain amount of social turbulence. It means, in any case, a lot of social suffering. For students, it means a foreclosure of their future opportunities. You have to imagine what a 20 or 22-year-old student thinks of. They're about to get their BA or move on to their MA and then leave the university to find a job. There's very little prospect today to find decently paying jobs in the economy. It's true in France, that's true in Germany, that's true in the United States, that's true pretty much everywhere. It's also true in China. So that people understand that there's a linkage between the economic crisis and their life prospects today and tomorrow. As this is occurring, in the midst of this crisis, the government here is saying that we have to cut down the public sector. But the public sector is the strength of the French economy. It's not its weakness. Everyone also knows, ever since Keynes, we all know that under periods of economic recession, and much more so, still more so, under periods of economic depression, the government has to act to reinforce the public sector to support the population and the private sector to support jobs. This is, I mean, elementary, you know, this is 101 economics, anybody who studies Keynes. But the government here is cutting back on the public sector in the midst of the economic crisis. And the population here, the student population, the professors, the rest of the population, the general population, is beginning to see in this a policy that is going to lead them straight into the wall.
In response to the crisis and the street protests, Sarkozy spent over an hour last week on a live televised interview with hand-picked TV personalities. The program aired on three channels as well as radio.
Je suis quelqu'un de très déterminé. Et quand je prends un engagement, j'ai l'habitude de le tenir. On m'a fait beaucoup de reproches dans ma vie politique. Pas de mentir.
Alors, Monsieur le Président, on se rend bien compte,
I played a little clip for Philippe Golub of the University of Paris, even though I don't speak French, to get his reaction to the Sarkozy show. I'm not sure if that was substantive or not.
It was about as substantive as the rest. He said he was very determined and that he never gives up what he started. So that could mean two things. It could mean either that he's totally inflexible, in which case he's going to be facing very serious political and social problems over the next couple of years, or it means that he is trying to reestablish his authority over a population which considers his policies to be increasingly inoperative. I'm not sure whether that exercise is actually going to work. You cannot tell people that you lead if they no longer believe that you are leading. Authority can only be constructed through consent. You cannot develop authority through the imposition of policies.
For Capitalism and Its Discontents, I'm Eric Klein.
You're listening to Capitalism and Its Discontents, a special five-part series on the global economic meltdown. I'm Sasha Lilly. Tens of thousands of international activists, trade unionists, anti-capitalists, and members of the global justice movements descended on Belém, Brazil, for the annual gathering of the World Social Forum. They spent 6 days debating and strategizing at what has come to be recognized as one of the major convergences for the left globally. Influential social theorist Boaventura de Sousa Santos spoke at the World Social Forum, with a simultaneous translation into English, about the financial crisis and how it is transforming worldwide economic policies, including the previous neoliberal rejection of state intervention into the economy.
It's going to bring the state as a solution back into the organization. We've seen in the past 30 years, the state was a problem for the World Bank, for the IMF. The solution was civil society. So they talked about market. And of course, the state was a problem. And for this reason, the countries of Latin America and Asia and Africa, for 30 years, requested policies that the United States are now applying in Europe. For 30 years, they asked for more control on the economy. They asked for nationalization of banks. All of this was verboten. But today, Portugal nationalizes banks, Spain does too, so does England. The United States has nationalized banks. This is the socialism of the rich that we are experiencing. And so for this, other countries, nothing has remained. So look, this is a new position, the state. So let us come to the political conclusions in the first place. We've always argued that the state should have a central role in economic control because the states are the ones that construct the struggle and the political struggles have emerged from this. And we have global struggles, but they have always started from the policy, which is the state. And if the state has this role, then it is important that it should be completely transformed. It can't be this state. So how can we do this? It's very simple. And this is my very concrete solution. Struggle here and in Ecuador and in Bolivia, as in other countries.
That's Portuguese sociologist Boaventura de Sousa Santos speaking through a translator at the World Social Forum. André Gribicek is on the governing body of the World Social Forum, known as the International Council. He talks with Ramsey Canan about the gathering.
You just returned from the World Social Forum in Belém, Brazil. Can you start by telling us what the World Social Forum is?
World Social Forum emerged in 2001 as an initiative of eight big Brazilian organizations representing very different constituencies, but trying to respond to a very practical thing. Namely, at that time, 2001, the idea of World Social Forum was to organize a big counter Davos event, so a counter event to the World Economic Forum. So in 2001, the first World Social Forum shifted from what is a sort of a counter W World Economic Forum to a completely different site of struggle. It assumed the role of, well, we might call it even of a global civil society with different social movements, different personalities, different NGOs came in order to exchange ideas and also make decisions about the particular nature and political direction and strategies of the so-called anti-globalization movement. It became a very significant political actor, and it was locally, it was used in Brazil in order for Lula, president of Brazil, to come to power. It was extremely instrumental in channeling and articulating the different resistances in Latin America.
We just heard an audio clip from the Portuguese social theorist Boaventura de Sousa Santos speaking at the World Social Forum about the need for the left to take control of and transform the state as an instrument for social and economic transformation. You fall on the other end of the left spectrum as an anti-statist anarchist. Tell us your take on that approach.
So yes, Boaventura de Sousa Santos is probably the most influential theoretician of the World Social Forum. He is an absolutely exceptional thinker. But I think that I will have to disagree with his new strategic orientation. Namely, he thinks... My impression, talking to him during this World Social Forum in Belém, is that he thinks that the urgency of the situation, urgency of the so-called crisis, is so huge that we need to refocus on the state as a site of struggle. I disagree. I think this would be a mistake. I think that right now there is not a sufficient evidence for us to be changing the nature of our involvement, which so far excluded any action related to the state.
But don't you need the state to provide that bailout, that social safety net, that welfare? That's
why I'm so confused about Boaventura's remarks, because he knows, of all people, that the state was essential for capitalism over a few hundred years. State is an essential element in the capitalist system. So this is not a surprise. This is not anything new. This keeps happening throughout the history of capitalism. So I don't see why would state, I think he called it socialism of the rich, why should we counter this with the socialism of the poor by using the state? I think, if anything, the anti-globalization movement and World Social Forum process contributed in a sense of a significant intellectual clarification that what used to be a self-evident goal in the socialist tradition, namely that we need to change the world only by taking the power of the state, I think that this has been removed as a strategic goal. I was listening to Evo Morales, and I was listening to Subcomandante Marcos, and the very same refrain came from both of them. They said that our goal should not be aiming at taking state power, the power of the state, although paradoxically Evo Morales is a president of Bolivia, but actually in listening to what both of them called the below. They're using a Spanish term called mandar obedeciendo, means leading by obeying. And the idea would be not to take the power of the state, but to aim at creating a sort of a linked self-governed bodies governed from below. And whomever is in the position of power needs to listen to these institutions from below. In other words, the most important actor is the social movement. And I don't know what Boaventura's response to this would be, and I'm sure that he would agree. But I think that we really need to put this archaic idea, this defeated idea in the socialist tradition, that we need to take the power of the state. And if I may add also a very Eurocentric idea that comes from the experience of Europe, has been imposed to pretty much everywhere, to the rest of the world, in a violent conquest. So the idea of nation state, or idea that we need to change the world by taking the power of the state, I think is profoundly wrong.
And so how did the current economic meltdown, how did that color those kind of debates that were going on at the World Social Forum?
I think that it brought a new sense of urgency. There is something that is called the Strategic Commission of the International Council. The main person is François Houtard, a famous leftist theorist from Belgium and liberation theologian. And there is a serious, serious assessment that this crisis really is not just another crisis. It's a systemic crisis of capitalism. And we right now, according to the Strategic Commission of International Council, need to be thinking very seriously about the alternatives. And according to people like Boaventura de Sousa Santos, we need to be voting on particular alternatives. What kind of an alternative to capitalism, not only neoliberalism, and this is, I think, very important to stress. This is the first World Social Forum that we were not talking about neoliberal globalization. We were talking about capitalism. This was the first anti-capitalist World Social Forum. And again, we had more than indigenous from more than 50 countries. We had 100,000 people. We had an amazing sample of what could be called the global civil society. So there is something really interesting in the air, and this crisis is putting everything into a very new light.
So in that light, what do you think were the most promising strategies and directions that came out of the World Social Forum, perhaps other than voting on certain decisions?
There is still a huge struggle between three main strategies. One could be described as local. Namely, the idea would be that the key to a broader social change is going local, like the Zapatistas, in a sense. The other is the advocacy approach. Advocacy approach would be organizing around single issues, for example, different campaigns, stopping Shell oil, or whatever, privatization and so forth. The third approach would be, third strategy would be, as you described it, getting back or going back to the state and getting seriously involved with the option of the state, using the state in order to transform this global reality of crisis. So there is a serious struggle between these three tendencies and three strategic options. And you can see a lot of nervous reactions at the International Council. It's a heated debate.
And where do you find yourself falling on these debates, or which of the three strategies that are being debated would you be advocating for?
So I think that I would find myself a dissident in this debate. I think that all three strategies are wrong. We need to find a sort of way of remaining independent from the state, remaining independent from the particular politicians, especially in Latin America. But at the same time, I think that being and working only locally is a mistake. So I think that we need to reformulate, we need to think more thoroughly about different strategies. And there are many other people at the International Council, I think, and I hope, who are starting to think in this particular direction.
So do you think that the current economic crisis has, or could it, or is it, and perhaps your experience in the World Social Forum could speak to that, is it a way of generating interest in the left? Does it revitalize the left? Does it have new opportunities for the left?
Oh, yes, definitely. It brings many new opportunities to the left. But if you look at the crisis, if you look at the people, I'm not so much interested in the crisis as much as I'm interested in the response to the crisis. If you look at Europe, if you look at Latin America, there is, on one hand, there is a serious analysis of the crisis. For example, I'm together with the Global Commons group. I will be participating in something called the Thematic Forum on the Crisis of Civilization. It was put by the indigenous groups. They're talking about, and these are indigenous groups from Amazonia and from other places in Latin America, talking mostly about the crisis of capitalist civilization. They perceive this as a crisis of capitalist civilization. And I think this is a very good approach to the problem. The other response, if you look at Europe and Eastern Europe, where I'm coming from, you will see a lot of riots. left doesn't have much to do with those riots. These are riots of young people, dissatisfied people, people who are rebelling, people who are rebelling for different reasons. But people, these are very interesting constituencies. These are football hooligans. These are young people who are protesting against new IMF reforms and World Bank and so on and so forth. But there is not much of a direct involvement on the side of the organized left. This is something that we need to change.
Is it the case, and you are from the former Yugoslavia yourself, is it the case, we talked earlier in this series with a correspondent from Hungary who was saying that the left there is in disarray and it is the old guard or the old style socialist left which is actually putting forward these IMF austerity reform packages. Is that the case in the former Yugoslavia?
Yes, it is. It's not the old left, though. This is in Yugoslavia, neoliberal left is right now in power, not the old left. But it's the same. And Yugoslavia, in this case Serbia, just accepted a deal very similar to the deal that Hungary accepted, with the same kind of structural adjustment reforms that were imposed, reform of the public sector and so on and so forth. So IMF... remember, we are not the only ones who are trying to use and make use of this struggle, of this crisis. IMF, World Bank, WTO, they're also trying to get back on the scene by implementing and imposing new, very old reforms. So there is a struggle. There is a huge struggle. There is a response to the crisis coming from the below, and there is a response to the crisis coming from the above. This is going to be a struggle that's probably not going to be a very pretty one. And we need to act fast. We need to entertain as many different utopian visions as possible. We need to think about alternatives. And we need to get really serious about actually working with the people who are resisting this. We can call it crisis. We can call it something else. But in any case, people who are now, I think, rebelling against capitalism. And there is a change in semantics with World Social Forum from neoliberal globalization back to capitalism, I think is extremely important. Few years ago, you couldn't really talk about capitalism. Now, if you talk to people in the streets, everybody is talking about capitalism. And I think this opens a huge possibility for the left. But left needs to get very serious, needs to get organized, needs to start talking about vision, about alternatives, and about different strategies.
And that was Andrei Grbacek, member of the International Council of the World Social Forum and co-author of Wobblies and Zapatistas, speaking with Ramsey Kanan. We'd like to thank Amark and producer Shane Elson for audio from the forum. You're listening to Capitalism and Its Discontents, a Pacifica special five-part series on the global economic meltdown. I'm Sasha Lilly.
The American people have lost faith in the leaders of some of our financial institutions, and they are skeptical that their government has used taxpayers' money in ways that will benefit them. This has to change.
That's Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner unveiling the latest government program to bail out the U.S. banking system. Geithner is reported to have prevailed over colleagues who wanted more severe salary caps for executives at banks receiving government aid. Stock markets plunged on fears that the bailout wouldn't shore up the banking system. Richard Walker teaches geography at UC Berkeley and is the author of The Conquest of Bread. I asked him whether he thinks finance is, in fact, at the root of this economic crisis.
Well, I do in part, because I do believe that the financial sector has a certain autonomy, as we on the left like to say, relative autonomy. But it does have a possibility of manipulating and multiplying itself. And we've seen that in spades. Now, say later about why that is, what it's based on, though. So, yes, finance did run amok. And financial bubbles are a normal part of capitalist crisis. And they, you know, every normal business cycle doesn't have a big financial crisis. But it's clear that every 50 years or even more often there is a really big one. And we're in the middle of one of those. But that's been true going back to the 18th century. So I do think financial crises have a role to play. And the worst capitalist depressions are ones where the financial crisis is the worst. So I think we can be clear about that. But that's not, I think, the underlying cause of this one or of any major capitalist crisis.
How have derivatives played a role in destabilizing the economy globally. How has it actually played out mechanically?
Well, the way it plays out is it allows them to multiply this paper. You're doing things on credit. You're leveraging all these investments. You're betting and counter-betting on the way the markets are going to go. And this stuff can multiply. So a derivative is a bet against the future. It's an option or a call or whatever that allows you to bet on how things are going to go. And then what you can do is you not only have your basic financial assets, stocks and bonds and so on, but then, you know, you've got all this kind of casino that's really betting on that basic, those basic paper assets. But it's all paper, and you can easily spin out the paper until, you know, it's this vast, you know, it's a pyramid, these nice, all these metaphors like pyramid schemes, Ponzi schemes, house of cards. There's a lot to that. It's paper upon paper, and we see, I think the figures in this crisis are that most of the banks were leveraged at least 30 times, so probably closer to 100 or 200 times. And, you know, that's just, you enter the realm of fantasy where the real assets underlying these pieces of paper just aren't as valuable as the pieces of paper. And ultimately, it has to come back down. Real value, as Marx said, has to assert itself. And you can play on this to a degree, especially in a growing economy, but you can't play on it indefinitely.
So one might then conclude that if these financial instruments, derivatives, stocks, credit, futures, things being used in ways that hadn't been seen, say, 30, 40 years ago, that if that is propelling the crisis, is then the answer regulate these things and capitalism will tick along normally. Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, I do agree that you have to regulate it. But the, you know, the horse is out the barn door already. So you're regulating it for the next time. So that isn't going to solve this crisis. It's just to keep this kind of madness from happening. So you do have to keep these guys under some kind of control. You got to keep them on a chain because they become kind of collectively mad dogs if you let them off their leash. So you got to keep that leash pretty tight. And that's what regulation does. Because there's so many clever guys and they figure out how to make this money. And in the short term, they make piles of money, as we've seen. They get all the bonuses. And that's a huge incentive for them to invent yet another derivative, yet another CDO or whatever the particular financial instrument is. And it doesn't really matter what it is. And most of us can't even comprehend that, all the details, because these guys are so clever. But in the end, the reality is you've got to know where the real money is, where the real value is, and you've got to keep some control over this process of leverage and inventiveness that's really, you know, spinning cotton candy. But it's not going to solve this problem. And what's happened now with the financial crisis is that the bank system and the credit system freezes up. And then it redounds to the real economy, and it makes the crisis worse.
Well, let's talk about the distinction between finance capital, manufacturing capital, the real economy, and whether this stuff is just froth. It's been said fairly often that the division between finance capital and industrial capital has been blurred to the point of disappearing. For example, GE derives more of its revenue from financial services than traditional washing machines and refrigerators and so on. Do you agree that that line has disappeared? And if not, how should we understand that division now in the middle of this crisis? How are the dynamics of this crisis playing out differently, say, within industrial capital and finance capital?
No, I don't think that that's actually blurred. I think you can still distinguish industrial capital, which is money invested in actually making things, from financial capital, which is money invested in lending and other kind of credit that's going to make money and interest off of those who actually make things. So those two are still fundamentally different. To the degree they got blurred, it is evidence of the financial sector getting out of hand, of financialization, that a GE or a Sears or a Westinghouse or a GM would be making more money out of their finance, as they have for almost 20 years now probably, is a sign of something gone wrong, actually, of an excessive amount of finance relative to the amount of production going on in the American economy. Now, that may not be in the world economy, but certainly in the American economy. So no, capitalism, and there are some people kind of who say that this blurring means as a long run trend, that means that of course we have to let finance sort of flower or do its thing. It's absolutely essential. We can't cut it down off. We can't reduce it. That's not true. We can really squeeze down and have to squeeze down the financial sector and get back to the business of producing things, even for the good of capitalism, let alone for the good of the rest of us.
Some of that's happening organically in the middle of this crisis. I mean, the five investment banks are gone.
Yes, we're getting a major financial restructuring. It is squeezing out a lot of the fat, and that does happen in a financial crisis. Huge amounts, trillions of dollars have been vaporized, as they are in every crisis. I don't know what the current figures are now. In the last crisis back nearly 2000s, about $7 trillion vaporized. The figures now for this one, I believe, are already higher, and it's by no means done. So there's a lot of funny money out there, and I'll come back to that with what that means. But yes, that is being squeezed out, and some of the worst purveyors of the kind of junk of finance, the big investment banks, are gone. And that's actually to the good. I see no problem with that.
Right. But of course, at the same time, other producers of what you call real goods are also shutting their doors.
Yeah, because there are three functions of finance. There's everyday credit, which we call commercial credit. That's the short-run lending. And that's what froze up. It actually froze up first in 2007, August 2007, then froze up again in September, October 2008. And it's still very, very rigid. And this stuff it's very short-run loans that allow business to simply get over the problems of cash flow. Normally, this goes on all the time, and it's huge. And nobody notices it because it's kind of like the motor oil in your car. You know, it's not very glamorous. You don't think about it. You don't go to the gas station and fill it up all the time. The only time you notice is when you get an oil leak and it all disappears and your engine burns up. And that's what's happened. Now, that's the first kind of credit. The second kind of credit is investment credit, where you're actually lending to businesses to build factories, buy machines, set up a store, or to consumers who are going to buy that car or buy a house, mortgages. That's long-term credit. That's very important. It also comes from the banks. We're a little more aware of that. And that, too, of course, has dried up right now. And that doesn't have the immediate effect of bankrupting businesses, but it does have a pretty dire effect on people's ability to buy houses or buy cars. And, of course, that cuts back on car demand, auto demand, which is one of the reasons Ford and GM, are doing so badly right now. And then the third kind of financial operation is the casino. That is, you take paper assets that are past credit, essentially, and are assets that are representations of real things, like my mortgage then gets resold in a secondary market. Those pieces of paper fly around, and they serve some function of allowing money to move from one area to another, surpluses to move from an area like Abu Dhabi to New York and then be lent out to real business. But most of that, the vast majority of it, is actually just a casino, and it's just speculative in that sense. And there's a big elaborate argument that, this cushions risk. It evaluates all our industries and our countries. It really sets the standard and so on. And there's some truth to that. But, of course, when it gets out of hand, as it did, there's no truth at all. It's just, as Susan Strange called it, casino capitalism. And that's the part we really don't need. That's the part you should tax. That's the part you should really clamp down on.
So it seems pretty indisputable that finance has been a central part of this crisis. But stepping back, there have been a number of debates on the left about crisis under capitalism. Of course, we on the left are often inclined to see crises when they're not happening.
Yes, we predicted five out of the last two crises.
Exactly. So there is an argument that this current crisis is a kind of a hangover from a fall in the rate of profit originating in the 1970s, and that now the chickens have come home to roost. That's not, of course, the only argument on the left. But What do you think about more deeply structural explanations of this crisis, and where do you position yourself?
Well, I think these kind of crises are inevitable product of growth spurts. I mean, this is in Capital, Marx is really trying to analyze how capitalism works. And of course, he puts at the center of that the accumulation of capital. And, you know, it may be based on the exploitation of labor, but the accumulation of capital is the driver. It is the engine of the system. And what he wants to show is that it's that driver that is going to fail, that it inevitably comes up against its own contradictions and creates crisis. Now, of course, the struggle between capital and labor is, in some sense, the ultimate determination of history, and, you know, the worker revolt and so on will presumably oust capitalism one day, we all hope. But in the short run, his theory of crisis is much more centered on accumulation. And accumulation runs off the rails periodically. It gets going faster and faster. You get these booms, which are, you know, part of the sort of wonder of capitalism, that it is so dynamic that it creates these growth spurts, these huge booms. But they get out of hand because capitalists overinvest. They invest in too many factories, too much machinery. They produce too many goods. And at a certain point, they go into an over-accumulation crisis. They also create, by the way, too much credit. It's part of this same process. And they get an overaccumulation of capital. There's not enough surplus to validate all that capital, to valorize it, and the rate of profit falls. And to me, that's still the basic Marxist analysis of why crises occur. Now, if we look at the sort of historical record, it's clear there was a great boom after World War II because so much capital had been destroyed during the war and during the Depression, the Great Depression. So the outlets for investment were very great. And the rebuilding of Europe, the triumph of Fordism and American technology was such, and American workers was such, that you could make a lot of stuff. People bought a lot of stuff. There was a lot of profit to be made, a lot of surplus. Now, that ran into trouble by the late 60s. There was an overaccumulation crisis, a dramatic fall in the rate of profit, starting in the late 60s through the mid-70s. And that created that open crisis of the first 5 years of the 70s. Now, there's an argument about what happens in the next 25 years. And Robert Brenner's view is what he calls the long downturn. That is, this is going to be, there's a sluggish period. It kind of never recovers from the 70s. It revives a bit in the 70s and then goes down again. It revives a bit in the 80s and then goes down again. And it revives in the 90s a bit and goes down again. And there's a lot to that, that it becomes more unstable, you get more recessions, the average growth rate is worse, the average unemployment rate is higher. The whole performance of not just American capitalism, but the advanced countries and the global economy is slower, is more sluggish than in the great post-war boom. Now, there's another point of view that says, well, that may be true, but the last 25 years also represented this epoch of neoliberalism. There was a genuine revival based around some new technologies and certainly the growth of East Asia coming on the scene, Southern Europe, so that there were some real bases of genuine expansion. And I think that's true. But that period is going to come a cropper eventually. So you get 10-year cycles, even some shorter ones, but we've had this series of clear 10-year cycles, early 70s, another recession, early 80s, another recession, early 90s, another recession, early 2000s, and finally this recession, which hit too early because it's even worse. So that whether so you get the 10-year cycles, you may have a 25-year cycle, you certainly could have a 50-year cycle. And people argue about this. We don't have enough data points, speaking as an economist, to say, you know, is capitalism always have like 100-year cycles, 50-year cycles, long waves, right. All that debate about long waves. It's hard to adjudicate that because of the evidence, you know, you don't have enough data points. However, it is clear you have cycles. It's clear you have some shorter ones and some long ones, like the come down with a huge bang, and that's what we've got today. So whether it's a 25 or a 50-year is not that important. What's important is it's here and it was a natural product of capitalism. And then I would add, if we come back to finance, that this last period, however you cut it, didn't do that well. The underlying conditions, especially in the U.S., were not that strong, And that's the root of the financial crisis.
The program is Capitalism and Its Discontents on Pacifica Radio or online at kpfa.org. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Dick Walker. He teaches geography at UC Berkeley and is the author of numerous books, including The Conquest of Bread, 150 Years of California Agribusiness, and The Country in the City. So you were just talking about the dynamics of capitalism and this push towards accumulation and over-accumulation. Countries in recession have in recent years relied essentially on the United States as the buyer of last resort, that if they were facing a crisis of over-accumulation, they could export their way out of it and people in the U.S. would buy it on freely available credit, money borrowed from people's houses, credit cards, etc. Obviously, that's now come to an end. How do you think this crisis will play out for countries in the rest of the world that have been particularly dependent on exports?
Well, the United States has played this role for a long time. I mean, there was a deal cut with really after the Korean War to help Japan recover, which was going to be based on allowing Japan to export to the United States. Japan then develops as the leading edge of East Asian development, and that is spread through Northeast Asia and then Southeast Asia and now to China. Often really variations on a model established by Japan in many ways, and that included a lot of export, keeping wages down so that domestic consumption wasn't high enough to absorb all the production of these high rising productivity, extremely capable production systems. So the U.S. was indeed the buyer of the last resort. And the U.S., in some sense, generously, but also as a kind of Cold War strategy and as the hegemon of capitalism, said, okay, we're going to help you to develop by absorbing your surplus products. Now, in addition, the U.S. is such a huge economy that it isn't just that we're absorbing East Asian goods. We're also absorbing our own production. And to a certain extent, we've been able to do that. We developed a consumer culture. That's a long-run phenomenon. Extremely good. Americans are extremely good at buying everything. And behind that, a credit system that would facilitate that. And here, of course, the credit system. And we always have to be clear that the credit system is essential to capitalism. The credit system is a necessity and a positive. That is, you lend against the future, and in so doing, you actually help the future come true. If I lend you to buy a house, you can't. Who can save enough to buy a house? And yet, you lend on a 30-year mortgage, people can pay that monthly, and they get houses. And it's a good thing for everybody. It's a good thing for the economy, and in many ways, a good thing for the people who buy it. So credit is a necessary lubricant to this and engine of development. But if your economy is kind of sluggish, and if you're trying to kind of pump it up, and you don't know what else to do, you pump in more credit. And that'll allow you to buy more goods from East Asia, but it'll also allow you to buy more goods from your domestic producers, right down to McDonald's, that people have more money. And so they kept pumping up the U.S. economy and figuring out ways to get more credit. And the blow to the financial system is not just speculative cleverness, but a systematic promotion of credit to expand, keep the system growing when it was actually kind of chugging along at not a very good rate. So it exaggerated our ability to, you know, our sort of effective incomes, which weren't growing as fast as we thought they were. And in the 90s and the 2000s, this really gets completely out of hand because they start pumping up house values in particular, which, you know, houses are the biggest asset of, you know, 90% of the population. And so if they can pump up the house values by pumping more money into mortgages, people would get easy mortgages, and that pumped up house values. And you ask, why do house values go up? It's because people could get too much credit. So they were buying over their heads. But the good thing about that, which they discovered in the 90s, is that then people feel richer. And because they feel richer, they'll go out and buy more stuff, and they'll take out secondary mortgages or equity loans to go and, you know, put their kid through college or buy that boat or take a vacation or whatever it might be, or do home improvement, some of which is productive, but some of which goes beyond the actual ability not only of the individual to pay, but of the economy to ultimately produce enough surplus to pay that off.
Now that that has come to an end, I heard that the Port of Oakland, which is one of America's most important ports, that traffic at the port is down something like 40%. And most of that traffic is traffic coming in. So for countries that are dependent on the U.S. for their growth, and one country, actually, let me just take this to China, which is a country you have written about, and the tremendous growth of China along capitalist lines. In past decades, China has grown at 10%, astounding levels of growth. It's fallen now to 6.8%, which may not sound shabby elsewhere, but in China, just even to be able to accommodate the population growth and the population flowing in from the countryside to the cities, they need to grow at a pretty substantial rate. So if the U.S. has been the buyer, in many ways, China has been the manufacturer.
Right.
What do you think will happen to China, which of course has a quite a different economic system with much more planning and regulation than the United States. But what will happen to it, given that the U.S. is now contracting?
Well, China obviously is a huge exporter of the U.S. It's our second biggest. It's the second biggest exporter in the world. Actually, Germany's the biggest. People forget that. And the U.S. buys about as much stuff from Japan and almost as much from Canada as we do from China. But be that as it may, China, a big market for China's the U.S. and all the developed countries, so and including Japan, by the way. And if they're all suffering, China's going to suffer. There's just no two ways about it. Now, in addition, and we tend to think of all China's growth as being based on exports, but China has a huge internal market. And the big stimulation to the Chinese internal market in the last few years has also been a property boom. The amount of construction, you know, something like half of all construction in the world was going on in China, maybe more in the last decade. And that property bubble is imploding too. Property bubbles all over the world are imploding. Now, China controlled its credit formation much more. But the interesting thing about capitalism is even in a situation where China didn't, you know, deregulate crazily the way we did, and didn't let its financial system run amok, they still got a property bubble because that's the way capitalism works. The property sector was booming, values are going up, capital flows in, everybody wants to make money on it, and then they overbuild. It's a classic capitalist overproduction, overaccumulation cycle.
Well, so moving into talking about how will this play out? As you alluded to earlier, the last 3 decades have been characterized by what's known as neoliberalism, deregulation, laissez-faire, free markets, and the evisceration of the welfare state. Government intervention in particular ways, although obviously government intervenes very much within neoliberalism to prop up the free market. Would you say that what we're seeing now spells the end of neoliberalism, given that obviously there is massive government intervention taking place in the U.S., in Europe, to try and shore up the capitalist system, essentially? Or is there something else at play here?
Well, in one sense, neoliberalism is over or has suffered a absolutely kind of critical blow. And the government is intervening massively. And no matter how you or I cut it, the fact is free markets are not being left to do their business. They're being taken over and propped up by the government to the tune of several trillion now. The Treasury and the Fed are in hock, not just for hundreds of billions, but for trillions. So, you know, in that sense, it's a done deal. So in one meaning. But, you know, there's other parts that are not a done deal. For on the one hand, there's the way they're managing the intervention in the banking system, the financial system, the way it's been done so far under Paulson and the way it looks like it will continue to go under Geithner and Obama is to prop up the banks and the banking system and keep them private and an enormous cost of living up to the ideology that banks and business have to be private. The government can't do it. And so the ideology has been very strong here. It's still a very kind of conservative, liberal, neoliberal version of intervention and bailout. It doesn't have to be that way, because you could buy, I saw a figure the other day, I think, in The Economist, that you could buy Citibank and Bank of America, all their stock, for about $50 billion now, which means you could probably buy the top four or five banks in the country for $100, $150 billion, which is chicken feed given how much we've pumped. We've pumped, you know, hundreds of billions, if not trillions, into these banks in the name of the ideological principle that, well, government shouldn't take over banks. No, they should do what Sweden did in the early 90s. You buy it. And it's not a takeover. It's not an expropriation. This is not socialism. It's just good business. You instead of giving them the money to and then rewarding the stock owners who have done nothing, you just buy the stock. It's legitimate. You buy all the stock at the current market price. And then later, when you've repaired the banks, you've kicked out the CEOs, you've cleaned house, you've got them back on their feet, the economy recovers, you can resell it to private business, private owners, private investors, and make some money off of it.
Right. The interesting thing, of course, that you just spoke about The Economist in the last issue, they now, of course, The Economist is, avowedly capitalist publication. In their leader, they stated that of the various measures that could be taken to shore up the banking system, one of them is bank nationalization. But then they said, well, as a capitalist publication, in fact, we can't really come out for this because, among other things, it undermines property rights. But it's fascinating to be at a moment, particularly after these neoliberal decades, of having a publication like The Economist even considering it.
Well, they're very torn. Because on the one hand, of course, they've got to prop up property rights and the whole business ethic and the whole ideology goes along with the market. On the other hand, they're not fools. And they see that this is kind of crazy. It's costing too much money. And that cost and the debt, the public debt itself, could bog down future economic growth. And they're ultimately interested in economic growth and profit making. It's actually not true that buying the banks at this point would violate property rights. In fact, it would meet property rights. It just violates the extreme liberal, neoliberal ideology, which says you cannot, private business knows best. And of course, we wouldn't have a crisis if private business always knew best.
To what degree is the capitalist class or classes in different countries, but say in the U.S., able to control the fallout from this crisis? There are dimensions that you could say were unleashed by the government, other aspects which are unleashed by just the inherent dynamics of capitalism itself.
Yes. Well, there's a couple of ways. One is, and because I'm not, with all due respect to one of my heroes, Noam Chomsky, I don't have a kind of hyper-functional view of the ruling class. I think they're in many ways incompetent. They're thugs. They get carried away. They just enjoy being rich, and they're not actually watching the store half the time either. Other times, of course, they can be incredibly manipulative and calculating and vicious. Okay, so given that, look at how much money we're just throwing down this rat hole of the banking financial system, trying to get it to revive. And the fact is, it hasn't revived. And you can see Paulson, every step he's taken has been the minimum step. And then he's had to do a bigger step and then a bigger step. So now they got themselves in to hawk for potentially trillions of dollars. I mean, I don't think it'll ultimately wash out as that much, $5 trillion or something. But it's still really bad, and the financial system is not revived. So actually, in their own terms, it isn't working, because this crash was so drastic, so out of hand. There's so much so-called toxic debt out there that nobody knows. And nobody knows where it is and how to clean. You've got to go in and clean the Augean stables and get your horses healthy again before they're going to take off. Now, the other thing, of course, the capitalists can't control is popular revolt and popular resentment. And this is where the other part I didn't get to about the death, potential end of neoliberalism, of course, would be the restoration of the welfare state, the restoration of greater countervailing power of the working class and popular movements. That's what we haven't had either.